Okay. So that we're going to do a couple of things today. One, of course, I would go back to the completion of the discussion we were doing last time, and then we'll probably do another topic also. But I also am supposed to teach you, discuss with you about a couple of things like academic integrity and scholarship opportunities. Okay, so I will do some of it here, but I'll also give you links, and some of these things is mostly to sort of tell you, for in the case of scholarship opportunities, that there are a variety of them available, and that sort of give you an idea as to where you can find additional information about them. So that's what I'll do, I guess, in the beginning of the class before we sort of go back to the discussion on complexity. But before I do that, I also thought it'll be a good idea to sort of ask you guys, how are you finding? I know one of you have expressed some comments about ASU experience until now on the blog. But I'm wondering how the rest of you surviving. Is it hard? Is it easy? How many courses do you guys are you guys taking, each of you? Like about 5, 6? Okay. So is there anything particularly surprising that you found? Are there any difficulties that we should talk about? That's also, by the way, part of, so this ASU 101, as I mentioned in the first class, it's sort of a grab bag of motivations for this course. You know, we are sort of supposed to give you, hold your hands if you are having trouble navigating the rough waters of ASU, and we're also supposed to give you an idea as to what are exciting in computer science. Now, what things are exciting in computer science depends, of course, on who is teaching you. You know, when I'm teaching you, I will tell you what are particularly exciting to me. So there is this interesting aspect that each class is 19 students, and so they're like pretty much all the CS faculty are teaching one section or other, and each of them wind up discussing different technical aspects of CS, which is okay, I guess. You know, you would get a slightly different tone of, you know, what is important in computer science. But the one part that's common is, if you need any hand holding, we should do it here, or we could do it over the blog, or we could do it over the email. You could come and talk to me. I'm bringing this up not necessarily hoping that somebody will stand up and say, please hold my hands, but that if you actually thought that was something, if you needed that and you didn't quite know where to look for, this class is also supposed to do that. Okay. So is there anything that anybody would like to bring up as to what has been, I mean, are anything that's particularly bugging them about the first 2 weeks, or it's 2 weeks, right? And then you guys get to take off for a weekend now, right? So because you worked so hard, you need the Labor Day weekend. Anything that anybody wants to bring up?
I did have one little question.
Sure.
I just had a father working on the computer. I tried running in. I know the community college I came from was like a math tutoring center.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are tutoring centers. I don't have direct links right here, but you know, I will post something to the blog. Yes. In fact, for computer science, they have increased the tutoring services, actually. And in fact, I just got an email, and I'll make sure that I'll forward it to you. Okay, if I don't, just please remind me. Okay. Please understand the following thing. Just sort of, you know, you need to understand how I come from. I'm much more worried about insulting your intelligence than challenging you. Okay, so if at the end of a class you think you didn't understand much about complexity, that doesn't bother me as much as if at the end of the class you think that I wasted your time teaching about stuff you already know. Okay, so that's the way I look at the world. And I'm just telling you this upfront so that I tend to overestimate what you might know. and including resources and so on. So this is a great question, because I may not have necessarily spent time sending you all that information, because I would have assumed it's easy enough for people to pick it up, but it may not be. Okay.
So,
okay, great. So so please, I'm just saying this. I'm being frank with you, because you know where I'm coming from. So questions, there is no, I mean, I think there's a Japanese proverb or something of sort that, there's no Japanese here, right? So I can tell you Japanese proverbs without making sure that they're actually accurate. But they say that the only stupid question is the one that wasn't asked. And, you know, essentially what they were saying is, I mean, it's just, you know, if you just keep it to yourself, worried that, you know, if you ask the question, you might look silly, that's not a reasonable thing. So I'll definitely get you the tutoring information, and then the rest of, I mean, I'll send it to the blog, and then, and I think you'll also get it as a email, and most rest of you will also get it, if you like it or not. Yeah, that also, I would again send you a link. Basically, there are a variety of clubs. As far as I know, the CS-oriented clubs are the ones that I would know a little more about than just the university level. But in the context of, I think, CS-oriented clubs, there are, I should just make sure that I make a note somewhere. Can somebody give me a sheet of paper? If you have one, it's not urgent. Thank you. I just want to make a note so that... Okay, so the clubs that I know are actually reasonably active in the CS side are, there is a Women in Computer Science club, and it's not exclusively for women. Okay, so I guess you two are welcome, but so are you, because I think they actually, and you know, there was a, one of the things that the Women in Computer Science club seems to be doing is hold seminars. And also, they also run the programming competition every year. Okay, so it's actually a pretty active club. There is also, I think, less active club, at least in as much as they caught my attention, like, you know, Linux users group and those sorts of things. I'll send you the list of things. There is, I think, an ACM students group, but I'm not quite sure that it's particularly active. Okay. I keep hearing about Women in Computer Science Club because they have been quite active. Okay. Other questions? Okay. By the way, these kinds of questions, please do ask me, because as I said, I tend not to, I mean, so there's ASU 101 has a syllabus of some sorts, and like, for example, I can get somebody to come here and spend an entire class teaching you about academic integrity, and somebody to come here an entire class and teach you about teaming. I actually barely need to even show up here. I can outsource all the classes. And somehow I tend to think that that might be a waste of your time, okay? But it's also the case that if I don't do any of it, maybe some of you are actually genuinely need to know something about what is academic integrity. I hope not, but you know, maybe you need to know. Regarding scholarship opportunities, I'm sure you know you would need to know some of the things that are reasonably well kept secrets. Okay, any other questions before we go forward? I think I have lost something. Yeah, you have. Any other questions? Okay. So what I was going to do is, I guess we'll have some soft discussion on academic integrity and also the scholarships, and then I'll go back to complexity, which I understand some of you liked, some of you didn't like, but we will try to make sure that all of us get some idea. As far as the technical discussions in this class, understand that this is a fail-safe class, right? In the sense, if you don't understand the entire details, it's still useful to know some of these things, because they might come back to you by the end of the fourth year, and it would all start making sense. Whereas if you just think in computer science as just a bunch of writing programs, then you're missing some of the bigger picture. Okay, so that's I'm not necessarily assuming that you will get all of this, but some of this is being said on the complexity, and we'll do other things just to get you to realize that there is these kinds of issues out there. You may, and in fact, there will be classes that will teach you these things again separately. Okay, academic integrity. So, has anybody, I mean, does, so I'm assuming that all of you know that if you are given assignments and they said it's individual work, you do individual work. Okay, I mean, that's for sure. And then I'm sure in pretty much any classes that you have been in high school, they took cheating quite seriously, right? The usual thing that I find as from my side as a professor is the best learning occurs when people are given homeworks, term projects, things that they get to do over a period of time without me looking over their shoulder and or during the exam proctoring, okay? And yet, as the amount of cheating sort of increases, those things get cut off. In many classes, eventually wind up becoming sort of very exam-oriented classes. Computer science, thankfully, is not like that. In fact, whether you like it or not, you have a large amount of programming projects, which you know you have to do outside of the class. But I do think that one worry about the way it actually affects your learning is, and I understand that you don't cheat, it's the other guys who cheat, you know, it's always true, but there is a social cost to it, because if there are enough cheating incidents, enough academic plagiarism incidents, then faculty are forced to sort of go with, you know, proctored exams, okay, which isn't really the, there are some subjects where you can just, you know, do a proctored exam and decide whether or not you learn something. But you learn a lot more by doing projects and doing homework. And, you know, in the classes that I teach, which normally 60 to 65% of your grade is based on the work that you do at home. Okay, and only about 35 to 40% is in two exams that you actually do, in a proctored exam that you do. Now, I cannot do this if I don't believe that people more or less play by the rules. And you know, I'm here to tell you that I generally think people play by the rules. Okay, I mean, whatever you might read in the New York Times article saying computer science apparently is the most plagiarism-ridden discipline because we are smart. We know exactly how to find the answers. Google it, right? And then they'll tell you answers for every exam, every homework. And when I teach classes, I tell my students that I know that for any homework problem I can give, there is a solution out there somewhere. Okay, in the old days, you had to actually go knock on people's doors to find out the solution if you want to, you know, cheat, and it would have been like costlier to cheat than to just sit down and do it yourself. But now, anybody can just Google it, right? And then I'm sure, and I as a faculty member, you'll be amazed at how interested people are in learning solutions to their homework problems. I will get, you know, mails from random undergraduate students from across the world saying, the following question seems extremely interesting. Could you provide me an answer? As if somehow this was like their research-related stuff. Mostly it would be because they got stuck in the homework and they're thinking if I can provide them the answer. But even that is not needed now because, you know, Google provides answers. And I think I'd be happy to tell you that there is actually a website I've realized, I forgot its name, but you probably know, which caches pretty much for each course that any university has, it caches all the old homeworks, old exams, and old everything. Okay, if we can't stop movie plagiarism, right, where Hollywood actually has liars, and they still can't stop, you know, movie plagiarism. I don't think universities can stop, the homeworks that I gave last year not getting onto the websites. Okay, the way I look at it is, I assume you're smart, and if you're smart, you would know that you can find the answers instead of thinking about it yourself. You can find the answers by just Googling. Okay, I just say in my own classes, I tell them that, you know, you're supposed to do it yourself, and if I can ever prove that you have essentially plagiarized, that's the only thing. That basically is the last one. In the sense, once you do that, the consequences would be dire. Okay, that's the usual thing. So you get caught, you will pay really badly. Okay. Until then, I assume that everybody is honest, everybody plays by the rules, because otherwise it'll be a police state. I would have to, you know, make sure that everything is done only in the class. I don't want to do that because most of the people who actually don't cheat would be losing their experience of doing work at home. Okay. I think, you know, these changes across classes, in the lower level classes, I think they have projects and they tend to have questions on the projects in the exam just to make sure that you did some of the project yourself as against just copying somebody's code. But in general, I think you have to get into the habit of looking at it as you are shortchanging yourself. You're paying, I think most of you are paying some sort of a tuition, right? And you're spending your time here. And if all you learned is how to Google for the solutions, you could have avoided four years of wasted time, you know, that you know beforehand. The question is whether you learned how to solve the problem, not whether somebody in the world knows how to solve the problem. And so that's something that, you know, I mentioned to the classes, you know, to the students in my classes. There obviously are, you know, gray areas in various cases. You know, for example, in the typical ASU policies, again, I'll say this generically, individual classes might do this very differently. And the best idea is to ask the instructor to make sure that you are on the right side. The typical ASU policy is homeworks. Unless they explicitly forbid talking to anybody, you're allowed to talk to people about their solutions, but you write your own solution. Okay, so after discussion, you come back and you write your own solution. That's normally the way homeworks are run. Unless they tell you, you can't talk. Okay, so the difference between homeworks and take-home exams. Have any of you done take-home exams in high schools? Yes, right, yeah. So I actually give take-home exams all the time. And you know, after about taking one or two of them, people think we would rather have in-class exams. Why? Because in-class exam is versus take-home exam is taking the Band-Aid off. It's one, you know, fast motion versus slowly pulling it out. Because if you have any respect for yourself, when you are given time, you'll try to answer the question, okay? And sometimes if you didn't learn it during the semester, you will try to learn it in solving the problems during the take-home exam, which means the exam can take a long time to actually answer it. Whereas in an in-class exam, there's 1.5 hours. At the end of one and a half hours, for better or worse, you're done, and you can go do something else, okay? But anyway, in take-home exams, the difference between homeworks and take-home exams is, take-home exams, at least in my class, I say, you are not allowed to talk to anybody about this exam other than the instructor and the TA. So if you can ask the instructor and the TA for clarifications on the questions, and you can also try to ask them for solutions, and I hope they know whether or not to give you solutions after giving the exam. But that's the main difference for those two. Exams normally are proctored. Term papers is another interesting thing. You know, actually people tend to take, again, I'm assuming, again, you all came from high schools and where people have told you some of this stuff, that if you take, you know, when you're writing a term paper, you are allowed to quote from other people, right? Except you should provide the citation, okay? Otherwise, again, you know, imagine, you know, pretty smart people gotten into trouble. How many of you know Doris Kearns Goodwin? She's a historian. She wrote the book on the Team of Rivals. What's Team of Rivals? That's the book that Obama was very interested in. That's a book about the cabinet of Lincoln during Civil War. And she's, you know, she's a very, 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 very respected historian. And she got basically dinged really badly one time because she essentially took pieces from some place and forgot to cite them. And you know, it never leaves you. You know, in fact, even a highly respected historian like her, basically, if she doesn't cite, then that's plagiarism. Okay. So you can take text, you can take ideas from other papers, as long as you say that those are the ideas that I'm taking from there, and then the teacher can decide whether you added anything more or not. At least you won't be accused of plagiarism. Okay. Please understand that the worst thing you can do for your academic career is to be accused of plagiarism. Okay, and try to avoid getting into situations, because once you get into that, the ASU policy has its own, you know, official policy. First the teacher talks to you, then if they don't get enough of a clean answer from you, then they will have to refer it to the college, then the college can refer it to the university, and you don't want to get into that. Okay? So basically my answer, my one single slide answer, I guess, to academic integrity is don't cheat. Okay, and there may be gray lines. In, you know, for example, homeworks, there is a gray areas. Term papers, there are gray areas. Ask if you are in doubt. Okay, and every, I, as I said, mostly I teach, you know, pretty much every semester. Mostly, I've been here since 1991, and I only had to deal with about maybe two cases of real plagiarism, in the sense that they actually would not admit that they actually copied and didn't show any sort of, you know, contrition, and so we had to actually follow it up. Okay, and there are a few other cases where essentially we could give big warnings, but in general, you don't want to do it and assume that the first time I get caught, I'll get a warning. That's not necessary, because it depends on the teacher. The assumption is the first time you do it is the last time you'll do it, and you might actually be out of the university in the worst case. So don't do it. That's my idea. Are there any questions on this stuff?
What are tangential?
Sure, go ahead.
You're stressing, you know, you don't, but that one thing I did notice is teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
The CSC and CS teamwork and projects, because I was walking as a junior,
mm-hmm.
and one of the 40% of the grade of my software engineering class was project grade, and it's like, form a team within 2 weeks, and I didn't know.
So it's a good point. Look, okay, so, well, when there is teamwork, first of all, again, it's different people. So I never, in my classes, I never ask for teamwork, okay? Maybe I'm a kind of a psychopath and a sociopath, and don't like people. No, I know that lots and lots of classes require teamwork, but that's also sort of true of the, so if you're going into, as much as it hurts me to admit it, many of you will become software engineers. Even though computer science is not just software engineering and a lot more, many of you will basically write, you know, software for some big firm. And it's not, in those cases, one single person doesn't come, you know, write the whole thing. You know, you have to learn how to work with teams. Okay, now when you work with teams, it's always this issue is there that some people are freeloaders and some people actually work hard, and you know, there are, again, this has been done, the teamwork projects have been done for a large number of years, and the instructors tend to have ways of figuring out at the end who did the work, who didn't do the work. Okay, I understand it will never be the case that it will be equivalent to you just doing your own project and nothing else. Okay, but arguments can be made that teamwork is important, and you know, and I think that's more or less what you will do. I mean, in fact, big software projects cannot get done just by one person sitting, you know, away from everybody else. And while it's not going to be exactly equal to you doing it yourself, there are enough checks and balances that anybody who suddenly drops out, stops showing up, etc., there are ways in which you know, the instructors will figure that out. In many classes, they will actually require you to keep meetings of the team minutes. Okay, as an instructor, actually, I find myself more on your side than the rest of the university. You know, I personally think, just my opinion, you know, which doesn't count for much, is that in the university we should, you know, I understand, you know, teamwork is important. We also want all of you to be individual stars. Okay, but I know companies hate individual prima donnas, right? Because then, you know, nothing gets done. Each of them are doing something different, and then it's not just companies. In any big projects, it's hard to work it, you know, make bigger things happen. So you know, I think it's an issue that people are aware of, and normally they have. So I was about to say that I do realize by the time you get to junior project, I had students in my class where they would rather just completely ignore the project for which they are completely responsible. Okay, because in my class, I told you, you know, all projects are your own, I mean, individual students' to individual projects. And I had students who tell me, oh, we could do this even though it's 60% of the grade because we had this other team project and I can't let the team down. That's a very American thing. You never let the team down, right? And in some sense, it's irrational, you know, because this person was actually losing 60% of her credit in one course just to be nice to her team in another course, which is for like 20% of the grade. What this does mean is people do take teams seriously. You know, unless you could always be unlucky and get hit with a bad team, or and you could also be like me and doesn't like any teams to begin with, and then you become a professor. That's a nice thing to do. But in general, there are enough checks and balances that people seem to like it. You know, I mean, enough number of people seem to like it. And then the teachers are completely aware of the situation. They normally have interviews with the team members, you know, at the end of the semester to make sure, you know, who did what. And yeah. Okay. Any other questions on this topic? Okay. So I will send you a link for academic integrity video, and I would request you to look at it because this is the one that Fulton has made, and it talks a little bit more about gray areas in, you know, what is cheating versus what is not cheating. You know, you're welcome to look at that video. You might want to do it, and my biggest suggestion would be, when in doubt, just check with the instructor. You know, and it's not that hard at all. Send emails. I mean, you're in computer science. Most instructors have email accounts. If not, they shouldn't be teaching in CS. Okay. Scholarship opportunities, there are a variety of them. I will send links to them, but one thing I want to mention is these two, FURI and REU program. It may or may not be, no scholarship is for everybody, right? I mean, you know, different people have different interests. The only reason I bring this up is these go, they don't get claimed as often, and they're pretty good scholarships, okay? So the FURI program is the Fulton Undergraduate Research Initiative. Okay, that's the program. And NSF-REU is National Science Foundation Research Experiences for Undergraduates program. And the interesting thing is NSF, for example, has a lots and lots of money that they give to faculty to allow undergraduates to get research experience. Okay, individual faculty decide what research experience means. It can be anywhere between you hang around in their lab and try to soak in the atmosphere to actually write papers and become famous, okay, and, you know, they're across the board. What's interesting is, for example, FURI, every semester there are deadlines, you know, for which you essentially can write, you can talk to somebody who might want to be your advisor, and you write a little application along with the professor, and then by the beginning of the next semester, they'll tell you, and they'll pay you, I think, 10 hours per week at a reasonable price. Definitely competitive with McDonald's, okay? May not be multiple times McDonald's, but definitely competitive. And you get to hang around, you know, in labs and figure out. So if you are in, let's say, robotics, you might, get somebody in robotics do this with you. And if you are in security, there are security professors. This is one way you get to actually really figure out whether you like an area or not, rather than wait until the end of 4 years and then get a chance to do that course and then say, oh my God, I've been building up this view of this area and man, this is no good to me, and now it's already end of 4 years, I didn't do something else that's more interesting. So I would strongly suggest that even though most people in the FURI program tend to be juniors and seniors, I've also seen enough people who have done it in the freshman and sophomore levels. Okay, so you should keep your eyes open on that. And there is a bunch of money there. NSF has a tons of money for this. And actually, speaking just for myself, whenever we write a grant, the competitive grant, you can always just ask them to add some more money for supporting research experiences for undergraduates. So, and that money can only be used to support research experiences for undergrads. I can't buy groceries with it. I can't go on trips to Hawaii. It only has to be used for undergraduate research experience. And I had, in my time here, I had actually sent back money once because I couldn't find interested people to work with, okay? So what I'm saying is that might actually say that I am a difficult guy to get along with, but I'm not the only person. There are lots and lots of people in the department who have this money, and you can, and you know, it doesn't cost them any additional money because this is only for providing research experience for undergrads. Okay, so you might want to keep track of this, and I think, in fact, in the Recovery Act funding, the one that Obama did, they gave a large amount of money for NSF, and NSF took a big chunk of it and said it can only be used for undergraduate research experiences. So there are lots of faculty members within CS who have money for like multiple undergraduate scholarships of this type. Okay, so I'm just mentioning this to you, and one other interesting thing about the Fury, obviously I assume that all faculty members value their time most, and you know, they really would, whether they'll work with you or not depends on whether they think they'll be wasting their time or whether you'll learn something through the interaction. And that's something that you will have to figure out. It's an apprenticeship thing, you know, unlike courses where I'm teaching and people get to read laptops and cell phones. You know, an apprenticeship, it's very hard. You know, you can't sit in front of somebody and keep looking at your cell phone, okay? At which point they will get mad. So I would definitely suggest you look at this. The Fury thing, actually, an unknown, one thing that's interesting about it is, actually in some departments, faculty members would love to get Fury undergrad students who work with them. Why? Because if you support and if you work with an undergrad student at the end of the semester, you get $500. Okay. Now you know that faculty members are not very well paid, and so they, you know, an extra $500. I have been told that there are departments where there is an actual competition, you know, to make sure that they get, you know, some number of students to work with them. You know, the point I'm trying to make is there are incentives for faculty members to do this too. It's not just for you. Okay, so you should be able to exploit that. Any questions on this stuff? Okay, so I think I've done enough of this stuff. And please do ask me any questions about these kinds of things, and I'll send you mails on these clubs and the tutoring opportunities, and also maybe links to the scholarship opportunities. So I will do for the rest of today's class. We will go back to the complexity stuff, and I want to continue some discussion on that. One thing I have noticed is, for some reason, I don't know whether people were just following the other people's lead and saying fourth question is hard. Everybody said fourth question was hard. The fourth question in the blog was, if your friend had a 2n algorithm for solving a problem, okay, and it's taking too long, and so the best problem, at the best instance they could solve without, you know, losing patience, was an instance of size 31, and their boss doubles their computing power. What would be the size of the instance they can solve now? And basically, if you double the computing power, then you can solve n+1 instance, which is not surprising at all, because 2n+1 is 2 × 2n, right? Okay, so just to do, if you double the speed, then within the same time, you would be able to solve an instance of size 1 more. That's it, just 1 more. And it's really, really, really depressing, okay? So when you are stuck with exponential problems, you can't just say, I'll wait for Brother Gates to come up with a next operating system, or Brother Jobs to come up with the next machine. You know, you really have to find interesting ways, you know, interesting, intelligent ways to improve the speed of the algorithm. Okay, this issue actually comes up multiple times. This problem of the exponential growth. One thing you will hear about pretty soon, maybe you have heard about it already in CC 101, are binary trees. You heard about binary trees, for example? What's a binary tree? A binary tree is a tree which has exactly, you know, it starts with one node, it has two children, and these two children have two children, and these two children have two children, like that. Okay. Now here's the interesting thing. if I have a binary tree of size, you know, where the number of nodes are, total number of nodes is k, okay, then I add one more layer. That basically means all the leaf nodes now have their children, right? What would be the size of the tree now, the number of nodes? What? 2k. Okay, basically it's, you know, the leaf nodes dominate. So the leaf nodes in any binary tree are as many as the entire interior tree combined, right? So this whole tree has k, and you add one more layer, you'll get k more nodes. That's the sad part of exponential growth. It's not just for 2, it's for 3 too. I mean, you'll have, you know, 3 power k is also exponential growth. We normally tend to think of 2 power k, but, you know, any n power k is an exponential growth. I'm sorry, any k power n is an exponential growth. Okay, that's regarding that problem 4. Let me try to make sure that we say this once again. This is the last slide that I sort of went through very quickly last time. So you essentially have all the problems where if I give you the solution and you can check whether or not it's polynomial, so whether or not it's correct in polynomial time, those are NP problems, okay? So that means if I give the solution and the program that checks the correctness of the solution will only take time polynomial in the size of the problem, okay? It will be some n power k. Then it's called an NP problem. The assumption actually is that you can generate all candidates in parallel. If you were able to generate all candidates in parallel and they're all checked for correctness in parallel, okay, and whoever says, yeah, I got a solution here, that will come out, okay, then the total time taken would essentially be just the time taken for checking the correctness of individual solutions, because you're doing all of these in parallel. Now, that's not the way you actually solve problems, but if you do have infinitely parallel machine, then NP problems can be solved in polynomial time. Okay, even if you have infinitely parallel machine, if your problem is above NP, then it still can't be solved in polynomial time. For example, Tower of Hanoi is a problem where the solution is exponentially long in the size of the input. And so to just check the correctness take exponential time. Okay, so there are harder problems than NP. We'll get to that in a minute. And within NP are problems that we know to be polynomial in the sense we know how to solve them. Somebody gave us an actual algorithm for solving that problem in polynomial time. That's the only way you know that something is a polynomial time algorithm. Okay? Now the question has been, is it, so some of the NP problems can be solved in polynomial time. Some others, we don't yet know whether or not they can be solved in polynomial time. The question is, are they really, so there is a problem, let's say here, is it one of those problems which probably will be polynomial if only a smart guy came along, a smart person came along and made an algorithm for it, and that's polynomial. Or is it that really it's a hard problem? It cannot actually be solved any easier than the hardest problem in this group. That's a question that you are stuck with, okay? And it's not just an idle question. It's known that you guys, I mean, you know, when we get into programming, we might find algorithms for simple problems that are actually pretty inefficient. We may not know. Like if the first time people write sorting algorithms, they probably will write n-square sorting algorithms. Okay, that's much better than the BOGO sort that I showed you, which is n times n factorial, which is really, really bad. Okay, but n square isn't too bad, but n square is not the most efficient algorithm. And so there could be problems where the best you could think of was an exponential algorithm, but there may be a polynomial one that other people know. So if you Googled for it, maybe you'll find it. Okay, and this can also be a case that nobody has yet found a polynomial algorithm for this problem. But that still is a polynomial time problem. And a classic example of that is this linear programming that I mentioned last time. Linear programming had an algorithm called simplex algorithm, which was what industry was using for the longest time, and it was known to be exponential. Okay, and it took until like late 80s for somebody to find a polynomial time algorithm for it, and then they were able to prove that linear programming is actually polynomial time, not exponential time. Okay, so given that, the question is there a simple way of saying that here is a problem in class NP, before I start writing a program, I want some sort of a guarantee that if I am, if I'm the best I can think of is an exponential problem, exponential solution for this problem, I'm not particularly stupid. Okay? Everybody else who tried to solve these kinds of problems also had trouble solving those problems. So in which case, at least all of us will think or swim together. Okay? And to do that, there is this notion of NP completeness, which is a subset of problems in class NP, which are sort of the monsters of the NP world. They have the following property, that if you ever find a way of solving this problem, solving one of the problems in this pink, thing in polynomial time, then every other problem in class NP can also be solved in polynomial time. Why? Because those problems can be first reduced to these problems in polynomial time, and then these problems can be solved in another polynomial time. So polynomial times polynomial is still polynomial. Okay? So the interesting question then is, there is now a way, barring actual solution of P equal to NP, whether or not P is in fact NP or not, we believe P is not equal to NP, but there is no proof yet. Okay, but that shouldn't stop us right now, because if to the extent you care about what your algorithms look like, you can see if your problem is NP complete. That means, is it one of the problems in this pink set? Or you can also, if in fact the pink set originally had, let's say, only one problem, somebody found one monster in the NP world, and you have your problem, you can say your problem is just hard as these problems by doing the opposite reduction. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I know this is a really hard problem, and you want to say your problem is just as hard. The way you will argue that is, you will say, here is a little program which will convert this hard problem into my problem in polynomial time. Okay? Do you understand that? Now, if my problem could be solved in polynomial time, then this must have been solvable in polynomial time too. Do you see what I'm saying? Right? It's you put the argument on its head. The whole reason of NP complete is every other problem will become solvable in polynomial time if the guys here are solvable in polynomial time. Now, if you want to introduce into this Hall of Fame one more monster problem, like you would like to say your problem is a monster problem too, you would do this argument. You would basically say your problem, any NP complete problem, any NP complete problem from this set can be converted into this monster problem. It can be converted into your problem in polynomial time, and then you can solve, if you can solve your problem in polynomial time, then this suddenly gets solvable polynomial, which means the monsters of, that basically means then that the hardest NP complete problems and the hardest problems in NP are still solvable in polynomial time, which means actually P equal to NP. So in that case, you would say, unless P is equal to NP, my problem is just as hard as the hardest known NP problems. And then you get to write exponential solutions for it. Okay. Just when you think that exponential is bad, we can talk about, are there worse than exponential? Okay? Are there worse than exponential? After all, if you can have 2 power n, who is a monster, then you can have 2 power 2 power n, which is a bigger monster. You can have 2 power 2 power 2 power 2 power 2 power n. And you can also say the program, here is a problem for which you can't write a program that will ever terminate. Just would not terminate. It's not a question of finite time. It'll just never terminate. That means it's worse than, it's basically undecidable. That means it takes more time. There is basically no finite time in which the program can get done. Okay. So the question is, are all computational problems at least solvable in finite time? Okay, and sometimes when you're writing your project code, you might be thinking, yeah, this looks like this is an undecidable project. You know, I'm not able to solve it. But what we mean in a formal sense is this computation actually doable in a finite time? And the answer, unfortunately, is no. Okay, there are many computational problems that cannot be solved in any finite time. You just hope that you don't have to touch them. Okay, but it's interesting that such problems exist, and so because they do exist, in fact, the interesting thing is that I said there's P and there's NP. This is where we stopped in the previous slide. So you can say there is a P, NP, and then there are higher, even harder problems, P space, which are all the problems that can be solved if you're only having polynomial amount of memory. Okay, and then X time, which are all the problems that can be solved in exponential time. And then X space, exponential space. And you can do double exponential time, double exponential space. And beyond all this is the problem can't be solved at all. Okay, now question is, I want you to actually, just as I told you, you know, Tower of Hanoi is a bad problem which has exponential time solutions, right? That's the only thing that it has. There are also problems which have no solutions at all. And two examples that you will probably learn as you go through, you know, computer science, maybe when you take logic courses, or maybe when you take, you know, AI courses, is one problem that is hard is, you know, first order, any of you know first order logic? You know Boolean logic? Okay. You will learn Boolean logic this semester itself. In fact, in the next slide, I'll show you some. And first order logic you will learn pretty soon, and maybe not, maybe in by junior year. And it turns out that in the first order logic, to check whether a theorem is actually true, okay, whether the theorem has a proof, is a semi-decidable problem. In the sense, if unbeknownst to you, the theorem you're trying to prove is actually provable, you can be done in finite time. Okay? Whereas if unbeknownst to you, the theorem you're trying to prove is not true, then you may never be done. Just never be done. It's not 2 power 2 power 2 power n. It's just none. Okay? And this is a big deal because, in fact, I think in the previous thing I said, Hilbert turns in his grave. At one time, mathematicians thought, instead of having mathematicians solving theorems, we can have computers solve theorems. Okay, and this is a bad thing because if the theorem that you're trying to prove is not actually true, the computer will never be able to come back and tell you it's not true. Okay, that's bad, but that's called semi-decidable. That means one side it is doable in finite time, another side it's not doable even in finite time. Then comes the really hard part, which is this guy is Kurt Gödel. What he showed was if you take first order logic and put arithmetic, just the normal arithmetic that you know, on top of it, then there may be theorems in that language that are actually true but cannot be proved to be true in any finite time. Okay? So here at least if the theorem was true, you could prove it in a finite time. Here even the opposite, even that also won't hold. This essentially means computizing all of mathematics is out the window. And from a CS point of view, also know that there are problems that can take very long time to solve. And of course, in fact, they can be problems that cannot be solved in any finite time. Okay? When you start taking, I think, a theory of computer science course, you would hear about something called a halting problem. Okay? The halting problem is a certain abstract machine called Turing machine, which can be seen as like the stand-in for any possible program in the world. Given this Turing machine, will it ever terminate? And you're trying to check that. And you're writing an algorithm to check whether a Turing machine will terminate. And that problem turns out to be undecidable. Okay, so that's similar to these kinds of problems. Okay? One last thing I will mention, and I'll probably come back to it next class when you come back on next Friday, is even though this is all really sad looking, that means I'm talking about problems that can't be solved in exponential time and that can only be solved in exponential time or even worse, or sometimes can't be solved at all, there is hope. most interesting problems tend to be, most interesting problems that you're actually trying to solve tend to be either in polynomial or exponential class. Okay, and even when there are in exponential class, one of the interesting things is that if you have a set of instances, an infinite set of instances of a problem, and one of them takes exponential time, then the whole set is dead. It's like you have a basket of mangoes. I'm into mangoes today. A basket of mangoes. If one mango is spoiled, you have to throw the whole thing out. Okay? So one problem is wrong. One problem takes exponential time. One instance takes exponential time. You have to throw the entire problem set and say it is exponential time. So what that means is, in the instances like of that problem, there may be most of them which actually can be solved in polynomial time. There are very few that are really hard, and those are the bad guys that gave the bad reputation to this class. The question is, can you figure out where the hard problems are? Okay. I was hoping to do it today, but I'll do it next time. We'll talk about Boolean logic and Boolean satisfiability problem. The interesting thing about it is, Boolean satisfiability is the very first problem that was shown to be in the monster class. Okay, so Boolean satisfiability is essentially you have given a set of Boolean variables and some set of constraints over them, and you're trying to figure out if there's a truth-falsity assignment to these variables such that all constraints are satisfied. Okay, and the first time anybody put something into that pink place is when they put Boolean satisfiability in the pink place. And then everybody else who had to say we are just as hard as other NP complete problems, they had to then show that Boolean satisfiability can be reduced to their problem. And then their problem also goes into that circuit. And then furthermore, other problems will go in. And we'll look at Boolean satisfiability and we'll actually find something mind-blowing, which is that for most of its life, Boolean satisfiability problems are extremely easy to solve. You know, we'll look at a certain plot where we'll see that most of the case, both on this end and this end, Boolean satisfiability problems are extremely easy to solve. And they become sort of hard only in the middle, which should not be surprising to you. We will actually make intuitive sense of the fact that you give up a problem if it's too constrained. If I tell you, for example, that you have to do these 18,000 pages of homework by next Friday, you would say, to heck with it, I'm not going to do it. And you will be done with the problem very fast by not doing it. Okay? And I can also give you one small thing and say, you just have to write your name in this place by next Friday. And all of you will be done with that homework very fast, because very little to be done. The way I can really mess with your life is to give you just enough homework that you feel it can be done, so you can't give up on it, but it takes time, so you keep working on it. This is what I try to do. Okay? So hard problems always live in the middle. And what is interesting is that we'll look at this next time, that hard problems live in the middle should not be surprising, but we'll actually find that not only do hard problems live in the middle, they live in a very narrow band in the middle. And it's called phase transition. And the reason we call it phase transition is that somehow in this one narrow band, the problems all want to become hard. On this side they're easy, on this side they're easy. This side they're easy because you would say this can't be solved very fast. On this side they're easy because you will give an assignment and say here is a solution for your Boolean satisfiability problem. It's right in that small band that the hard problems live. And the reason we call it phase transition is, when was the last time you heard about phase transition? Have you heard about the word phase transition? Did you ever boil water? What's boiling? Boiling is phase transition. As you heat water, right, all the time, even when the water is in the room right now, some number of molecules of the water are trying to become vapor. They're always trying to become vapor. The interesting thing about boiling is it's exactly 100 degrees centigrade, all the water wants to become vapor, right at one time. Okay, 99.1, it's generally a little bit. 100.1, there's no water left because it's all vapor. And exactly at 100, it stops increasing its temperature and all of it becomes vapor. Okay, you learned this in physics. I think you did. Okay, and there are people who got Nobel Prizes for explaining why phase transition occurs in water and all other things. Now the interesting thing is we will talk about phase transition computational problems. Somehow things become really hard in a very narrow band. Okay, we'll talk about that next time.